Inspired by my own journey with mental health, I founded Girls Talk, our own safe space where we share, listen, and support each other. So get cozy and join me, Adjoa Burr, for some much-needed Girls Talk.
Well, thank you so much, Holly, for being on the podcast. This feels like a very nostalgic, I was telling my sister and my boyfriend today, this morning, they were like asking who I was having on the podcast, and my sister was like, I can't believe it.
Oh, that's so sweet.
And it is, it's that, you know, I grew up obsessing over the Girls Next Door and obsessing over you and your girlfriends and what you were getting up to, which when I think about it now feels not odd because actually, but I was quite young to be watching a show like that. And I was like, that was something that my sister and I were talking about.
Yeah, it's so strange. A lot of families watch the show together and a lot of really young kids. And it was definitely a show that was presented in a way where you could kind of look at it two different ways. Like either you could have that intrigue where you kind of know what's going on because you're an adult and you're connecting the dots. Or you could kind of look at it as it was kind of presented as almost like a sitcom family in a way. Like I've had so many people contact me on social media and say, I used to watch that show when I was a kid. And I literally thought it was like a grandpa and his granddaughters. It was just so weird how it came off.
I think you're right. There wasn't like, I don't know if my sister and I watching the show knew what we were actually watching. I think we're both like inherently curious people, and you are even more curious when you're that age. And so to just have a kind of like, and also we're English, you guys are American. So there's that also, there's that curiosity about how these like American girls are like living their lives. I think it was more so that it didn't feel like seedy or anything, but it was just a funny show for my sister and I to like grow up watching. And I know a lot of like my generation and the one and people older than myself also grew up watching the show, but also knowing about it. But I know it's had a resurgence in lots of different sorts of ways, and you kind of have like embarked on such a different journey since then. But for our younger listeners who didn't grow up like myself obsessing over the Girls Next Door, can you introduce yourself to our wonderful community?
Yeah, I'm Holly Madison. I was on a show, like you said, in the early 2000s called Girls Next Door. It was a reality show about living at the Playboy Mansion. Since then, I've written books. I've done shows in Vegas. I have a show now on Investigation Discovery called The Playboy Murders and one coming out in March called Lethally Blonde. So yeah, I'm excited about those.
And I'd love to start at the beginning, you know, just to hear a bit more about how you grew up, what your childhood was like.
Yeah, I grew up in a really rural area in Alaska. I lived there until I was 10. We lived on Prince of Wales Island. And if you watch any of those Alaska survival shows, a lot of times they'll show Prince of Wales Island because it is quite rural. We went there on an episode of Girls Next Door too, so you can see it there. But it was a really special place for me to grow up. There was a lot of just playing in the woods and outdoorsy stuff and, you know, using your imagination. You know, everybody there was from very humble backgrounds. So there wasn't a lot of like materialism or feeling like you needed to keep up with the other kids in class or anything like that. Then we moved to Oregon when I was about 11 or 12. And that just felt like a culture shock to me. Even though it was small town Oregon, to me, it felt like the biggest city in the world. It felt like everything seemed so foreign. So that was an adjustment. And then my family and I would vacation every once in a while in LA. We would go to, or Orange County, we'd go to Disneyland. And I just fell in love with California. I loved the weather. I wanted to do something in the entertainment industry. I didn't even know what. I just felt like that was a way I could connect with people. I grew up like undiagnosed on the spectrum, and I always had a lot of trouble connecting with people and making friends and things like that, and didn't really know why. And I felt like if I could somehow be famous, that would be like a shortcut to feeling connected with people, which, spoiler alert, it's not, but it was worth a try. So that was kind of what started me on that whole journey. I was in college for a couple of years in Oregon, and I transferred down to Loyola Marymount University in LA. So I thought that would just be like the perfect foot in the door to get down to LA because I didn't know anybody here and I didn't have any money. So.
And what was coming from a place like Alaska? Like, what was your idea of fame?
Well, I think back then you could become famous if you were a singer or an actor. Yeah. There were very few other ways unless you were like a huge politician or something. And I couldn't sing. So I felt like I was going to be an actor or a TV host or something like that. And back then, just going about it was so different because there was no social media where you could showcase yourself or get comfortable being on camera. You had to go through the gatekeepers and, you know, it cost money too, because you had to either be in New York or LA. There was no like remote auditions back then, nothing like that. And so you had to move to an expensive city where you know no one, and you have to pay for all the headshots, and every agent wants a different headshot, and your headshot's never good enough. And, you know, things like that. You have to pay for the acting classes. You have to pay to get all your headshots printed out, which is expensive. Your portfolio, if you're doing any modeling. So it was a much more daunting task back then.
Yeah, 100%. And mm-hmm. what, I suppose, starting off, like moving to LA, what was the kind of life that you envisioned for yourself?
I just wanted to be happy. Yeah. I thought, you know, I had a little bit of seasonal affective disorder depression from living in the rain all my life. I wanted to be somewhere sunny, somewhere happy. I wanted opportunity. There wasn't really the kinds of opportunity, you know, where I was coming from. So I felt like being in LA, I would get, you know, the setting with the weather. I'd have the opportunity to, you know, work hard and hopefully do whatever I wanted. And, you know, I had this misconception that, you know, being famous would make me feel connected to other people and that it would kind of be a shortcut to meeting people and really feeling connected, I think is like the root of it, which I didn't understand at the time when I was younger. I just thought, well, I want to be famous and rich because everybody does. You know, you're not really looking for like the bigger, deeper meaning behind it. But as I've gotten older and I can see in hindsight, I can see that was what it really was. Like, of course, everybody wants to experience all the fun parts of it and the material aspects and things. But I think the reason I really had that drive and it really appealed to me was I felt such an emotional lack and such a lack of connection with other people. And kind of subconsciously, I thought if I could just be like bigger than life and all these people knew me and that it would be a shortcut to feeling like connected and accepted.
Talking of connection, and I suppose the word that comes to mind is also community. And I want to kind of go back to the Playboy Mansion and that kind of, mm-hmm. you know, that mansion, that home that you lived in for those years. For our younger listeners, I think they probably know now just because of the kind of TikTok and the rise of like we're talking about it again and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they're like, you know, aware of the cultural significance of the Playboy in the 2000s. But tell me about your kind of first time that you were invited to the Playboy Mansion.
Oh, I was so excited to be invited to the mansion for the first time because back then they threw like maybe a handful of parties a year and they were really exclusive wow. and hard to get into. And I got a job at the Hooters restaurant in Santa Monica and all the girls who worked there were beautiful and everybody wanted to go to the Playboy parties and maybe like one or two women who worked there were able to go and everybody thought they were so cool. And I was also working for Hawaiian Tropic at the time and at a Hawaiian Tropic event, one of Hugh Hefner's friends who was his doctor came. And he told the organizer, I want to invite all these girls to the next mansion party. So I was so excited to go. And eventually I also got invited to the smaller Sunday pool parties that they did as well. And for me, it just felt like a really accepting environment. You know, he had a small core group of friends who were always so friendly and welcoming to everybody. And it really felt like a community to me. You know, I felt like I had a little bit of community at the restaurant I worked at, but you know, there was a high turnover there. Nobody really stayed. I made a couple friends I was roommates with. They decided to move back home where they came from relatively quickly. And, you know, I didn't really have much of a social life at school. I was more just concentrating on academics and then like leaving campus and like trying to audition and work and mm-hmm. pay bills and do all the things.
Yeah.
So I really was feeling comfortable at the mansion. I kind of felt like that was my escape and that was my social life. And that was a place where I felt accepted and special and like I was this nobody, but like everybody remembered my name every Sunday and it just felt really good in the beginning.
Oh no, completely. And I don't think it's so important, you know, those just key words that you said about feeling special. Whatever path we choose to go on as young women and men, and you know, there is, when we're at that age, we are looking for that connection, we are looking for those people, mm-hmm. that community, that those hopefully like-minded people who make us feel like part of something. So How did you go from attending a mansion party to then living at the mansion as a playmate and then becoming Hugh Hefner's girlfriend?
Well, I was going to the mansion parties for about a year, and Hefner would talk sometimes. I thought he seemed like a really great guy. You know, everybody who surrounded him loved him so much. He seemed like such a generous host. He was definitely charming, you know, all the things. And I saw that he had all these other girlfriends, and I was invited to go out with them, but it wasn't an invitation I accepted right away just because I thought, well, that's not for me. You know, I want to do my thing and like build a career. And I don't think I could be with like, you know, six other girls. Like, I didn't know what they were up to sexually or whatever. It just wasn't something I thought was for me. But about a year into going to the parties, I was kind of in a tough spot where my roommate had went and like got another lease behind my back when I thought we were renewing the lease we had. And like, my credit was bad and I couldn't get a new place. And I was just living like paycheck to paycheck. And I thought, you know what? Because I was up there at a party on a Sunday and some of the butlers and bartenders were talking about how one of the girlfriends had just been kicked out. And I knew there was a spot open. And I thought, you know what? Maybe I should just try being a girlfriend. It'll just be for a short while. You know, everybody here seems so happy, you know, from my perspective, yeah. I thought. And it just seemed like something that was, you know, a little out there and a little like wild and crazy. I definitely knew I was, or thought I was going to look back on this as like, that was the crazy thing I did when I was in college, you know, but I felt like I needed to do it if I was going to continue like pursuing my dreams. I felt like it would be the perfect like bridge to the next thing, or, you know, a safe haven for a little while or something. So I told Hef, yeah, I'd be interested in going out with you guys. And then I moved in right away after that.
And obviously, you know, there were a lot of things that you kind of had to get your head around, you know, just doing something like you said, that crazy or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. coming from a different lifestyle than going to living in the Playboy Mansion. But things like, I suppose, the age gap, how did you yourself, I suppose, normalize particular things like that? Or was that something that just felt like part of the territory, you know?
You know, for me, I think I bonded with Hef really quickly, and I think that was easy for me to do and overlook the age. I mean, obviously, I knew it was very, very unusual, you know, but I was somebody who, like I said, had a lot of trouble connecting with people, and I didn't know why at the time. And I'd had a boyfriend in high school, but I felt like I wasn't really connecting with guys my age that much since then. So it was easy for me to fall into the mindset of, well, you know what, I'm kind of like this old soul type of person and I have a lot of common interests with this person. Like, maybe that's just what I'm meant to be. Like, maybe I'm just meant to be with an older person. Like, maybe that's just my vibe and, you know.
No, and I think it's like, and by no means was I asking that in a judgmental way, because, you know, now
now,
you know, we see women dating men far younger than them, and you know, it's completely mm-hmm. you know, the whole kind of like, I suppose, landscape of like age is completely different. But at that time, obviously, it was kind of like a very shocking thing, you know, someone going out with someone so much older than them. But actually mm-hmm. also like men were doing it all the time as well. But
yeah
I don't know, I can't even remember watching the show and thinking anything of it. I don't think that mm-hmm. was the reason, that wasn't where my kind of curiosity laid when I like was watching the show back then. But I mean, I want to talk more about this later on, and I think it kind of, you slightly touched on it, just this idea that it was like you had this connection with someone. Yes, they were older mm-hmm. but you were an old soul, and there were things, I think that's a very kind of like grown up way of looking at things. And I wonder if, like, obviously you weren't diagnosed, I know you're neurodiverse, but, and this mm-hmm. wasn't something that you knew back then, and I want to talk more about this later, but how do you think your kind of neurodiversity kind of influence your interactions and like relationships with like Hef and also the other women in the mansion, like looking back now?
Oh, a lot of different ways. I mean, I think first off, like I said, I fell into, you know, the trap of thinking he was perfect for me partway because, you know, he knows how to make people feel really special. And I felt like, oh, wow, you know, we're really meant to be together. I didn't really see it for what it was. And also, you know, I was a homebody. I liked to stay home a lot. Of course, he would take his girls out to clubs like a couple nights a week. But I wasn't into like going out and like partying myself. And, you know, I was really into pursuing my goals and just like, you know, staying home and enjoying what the mansion had to offer other times. And that really fit in with his lifestyle. Like he wanted somebody who was by his side 24/7. And as far as the other girls, I mean, I think that was a disaster too. Like I was one of the youngest ones when I moved in, and a lot of the women there were a lot more experienced than I was. A lot of them came from other types of things, like on the sex work spectrum. So they were a little more, you know, versed in what they were doing there and had a different attitude about it than I did. So we were kind of coming from just such different viewpoints. And, you know, people liked me at first because I was staying home and hanging out with Hef when they didn't want to. So it kind of took the pressure off. But then he started using that against them, you know, when they wouldn't do what he wanted, he'd be like, oh, well, why can't you just do this? You know, Holly does it. Holly always stays in. Holly does that. So then they were like, oh my God, we have to get this bitch out. She's making us look bad, you know?
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
What was that kind of, so that kind of, I suppose, that friction and I suppose bullying and degradation, like how did that impact your mental health at that point?
It was really bad. It made me completely paranoid. I felt like the walls had ears. I felt like there was no one I could confide in. Like my friend Bridget came along maybe like 9 months after I did, and we made friends. And, you know, slowly over time, I got to feel like I could trust her, and I felt like we could kind of go off campus during the day for lunch and I could confide in her. But even then I was so paranoid. I'd be just in a restaurant in LA, and this is before we were even on the show, so nobody knew who we were. But I was so paranoid that maybe the person in the next booth like recognizes us as one of Hef's girlfriends and is going to hear what I'm saying. And like, it's going to come back to him. Like I was just so terrified all the time of like getting kicked out and getting in trouble that there were so few people I would confide in. I think the whole time I was there, the only people I would confide in were Bridget and then Hef's secretary, Mary. Sometimes I would tell her things, and I would tell her things a lot, like hoping she'd be sympathetic with me and like maybe hoping she'd put in a good word for Hef if I was unhappy about a certain thing. And so those were really the only two people I was comfortable talking to.
And you've mentioned before and characterized kind of living in the Playboy Mansion as being like a cult. And it's with certain things you just said really kind of resonated to that kind of statement. Just the paranoia and the fear and the way things were used against you or used, you know, against other people. In what ways did the kind of environment at the mansion mirror a cult to you?
Yeah, I think it mirrors a cult in a lot of different ways. I think one is that you feel such a great sense of belonging when you first go there. And there's a lot of people who go there who do have positive experiences depending on like their level of involvement or whatever. But cults, I imagine, always feel good at the beginning too. Like, I don't think anybody's joining a cult because they're like, oh my God, I really want to go drink Kool-Aid and die. You know, nobody thinks that. People get involved for other reasons because they think they're part of a community or part of a family. And I also heard somebody say somewhere that like in a cult, the newest people are treated the best because that's kind of like the indoctrination level. And as you get more and more indoctrinated, you're treated worse and worse, which I felt like that was true for me because by the time I was like Hef's main girlfriend and sharing a room with him, there was just so much responsibility and pressure on my shoulders. And I was always kind of used as like the scapegoat and things like that. And like, there was always like pressure on me to make everything work, even though like I can't control other people. So that reminded me of a cult as well. And even to this day, you know, there's still like, I can't be out talking about my experience without other people who used to be part of like Hef's circle, you know, attacking me and blaming me in the media and things like that. It's just still that cult like thinking where like they can't accept that this person they were friends with was a multifaceted human being. They think he's like Jesus or something and he's perfect and can do no wrong. And if somebody says he ever hurt their feelings, like they must be the problem, you know?
Yeah, 100%. So I want to move on to your amazing docuseries, The Playboy Murders. Why did it feel so important for you to kind of tell these women's stories?
Yeah, it was an interesting journey. When my agent first told me about it, at first I didn't want to do it just because it's called The Playboy Murders. And I thought, you know what, I'm up to my ears in Playboy stuff. Like I'm doing a rewatch podcast about our show. And I was just, I had participated in a documentary. I was just interviewed for it. I wasn't really a part of it more than that, called The Secrets of Playboy, that was a really big deal. And I was just like, I can't take any more of it. Like, I'm having nightmares at this point. Don't want to do it. And he's like, well, just look at the deck they put together. I'll send it over. And I looked at the cases they had laid out for the episodes. And I thought, oh no, I would actually watch this show. Like, this is fascinating. It was a lot of cases that I'd never heard of. And I was somebody who thought I knew everything about the Playboy world and knew everything about whatever happened to anyone who was ever a playmate. You know what I mean? And so many of these things I hadn't heard of. And I just really dove in and got involved. And I do think the stories are so important to tell. You know, when tragedies like these happen, if there's anything that can be learned from it, some of the cases are unsolved. So if any new information can come out, I think it's so important to talk about. And I love talking about these stories because so many of them involve people, mostly victims, not always, but every story involves somebody connected to the Playboy world. And I can usually relate to those people in some way. And I love talking about cases that involve people who were sex workers or somewhere along the spectrum of sex work or had posed nude or something, because people generally can categorize those people and put them in a box and kind of dehumanize them. And I like to really dig into what else about this person, you know?
Oh, completely.
What else about this person can you relate to?
Yeah.
And really get into their story from that perspective.
Well, it goes back, you know, what I loved about the kind of just when I learned more about the Playboy murders is this idea of, it's kind of that community aspect a bit. It's like, you're obviously coming at it from a different angle, but like kind of giving in a platform to certain women, like you said, who might, people would have just brushed aside or not cared about or just seen in one light, and instead like, you know, picking it apart and showcasing them as like multifaceted, you know, incredible women in all different sorts of ways, I thought was like super cool. What have you learned from some of the women you've been able to highlight on the show?
Oh my gosh, so much. There's so many people I can relate to. I just finished the autobiography of Lori Benbenek, whose episode aired a few weeks ago as we're recording this. And she was somebody who worked as a Playboy bunny at the Playboy Club in Wisconsin for 3 weeks after she'd been a police officer. And she was, I believe, framed for murder. And when the media was covering this trial, they portrayed her as like this femme fatale, like Playboy bunny killer. They always run photos of her, you know, either from a calendar she did once or in her Playboy bunny uniform. And nobody ever ran a picture of her in her police officer uniform, even though that was her passion and that was her career of choice. And it's just so interesting to dig in and like read, you know, what she was going through from her point of view and just how incredibly unfair that first trial was. It just blows my mind.
So we touched on it a bit, but I want to go back and talk about you recently being diagnosed with autism. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to seek this diagnosis?
About 5 years ago, I got divorced and my ex-husband and my mom were talking about me, and she brought up that she had always thought that there was something about me. You know, back in the 80s, people weren't diagnosing autism as much as they are now, but that would come up sometimes. You know, I was always kind of zoning out as a child and interacting a little bit differently, and people would notice. And I thought, okay, that's strange, because, you know, I was like 40 at the time I'm hearing this from my mom, and I'm thinking, okay, weird. But I looked up some of the symptoms and some of the signs, and I really related to a lot of them. And I thought, wow, this could actually be a thing. You know, my idea of autism is, you know, they call it a spectrum for a reason, because there's so many people who operate differently and they show signs differently and have different, you know, symptoms and traits. And there's people who have a lot of trouble functioning in quote unquote normal life. And there's people who can function a little bit more quote unquote normal. So it's all over the place. But my thought of what autism was you have to be like completely nonverbal. And then, you know, I remember there was this Babysitter's Club book about one of the characters babysitting a girl who was autistic. And I thought that was what autistic was. And it was only that one thing. But as I'm looking up some of the signs of being on the spectrum, I could relate to a lot of it. And I started talking about it a little bit, you know, in interviews here and there, because I started noticing how the way I interacted with people and wasn't really picking up on social cues and things like that throughout my life was affecting my decision making. So as I'm telling my life story, I would want to say, well, you know, I think I made this decision because this is how I was feeling and this is how I was operating. But it's hard to talk about it publicly without a formal diagnosis. So I really wanted to go in and, get that done. So I felt like I could be a little more educated about it. And even now I don't consider myself any kind of spokesperson because people experience the spectrum so differently. You know, there's people who have a lot more challenging issues than I do.
No, so I think I think one of the main reasons we wanted to have you on the podcast, amongst others, for us, it was, I loved the way in which you kind of had navigated, like, publicly kind of talking about your diagnosis. Like, I think it's very easy for people to become the spokesperson for their diagnosis or what's going on in their life at that particular time, whether it's through, because they want to feel like, it feels like the necessary kind of direction one would take when they want to talk about something. And I think you did it in such an amazing way that left space for other people to kind of like feel part of it, but also feel like, you know, learn and see something different, but also know that, like you said, like it's multifaceted and there are lots of people dealing with it in all sorts of different ways.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. It's just, you know, sometimes people, like, I'll get comments when I talk about online, and sometimes people will get really mad and they'll talk about, you know, my son has autism and this is what I deal with on a day-to-day basis. And it's something so much more extreme than what I've dealt with. So I always want to acknowledge that. But also, I feel like a lot of people can relate to what I'm saying too, and have, you know, decided to seek out a diagnosis themselves, or maybe look into what could possibly be going on with themselves. So I think it's important to talk about, for sure.
Completely. Because it's like, obviously, and you know this, you've been in the entertainment industry for such a long time and you're a public figure on social media. Like, there will always be hate, but there is one person out there who's listening to your story who will feel like they can relate to you in some sort of way, and they can't relate to that mother. And that's like, that's a privilege in itself, but they can relate to you. So I think it's like, the story is still so very important, you know?
Yeah, thank you.
In what ways does, I suppose, you know, you said you've like kind of educated yourself on it. In what ways does autism present differently in women compared to men?
A lot of things I've seen people say is that women don't get diagnosed as often as men because women are better at masking. Masking is when you're like studying other people's social cues and just picking up and copying them, because you don't have the same kind of internal ability to just do it on your own the way like a neurotypical person would. So that's one thing, is women tend to be raised as people pleasers, and we tend to really put a lot of emphasis on women's emotional intelligence and women's social ability so much more than people do with men. So women tend to have a better time masking, I think.
And we spoke, I mean, I touched briefly on this idea of, and we talk a lot about it at Girls Talk, but this element of like storytelling and hearing one's story and how that makes us feel. And what that does in regards to certain areas and topics that are more stigmatized. But how do you think our society can, I suppose, become more inclusive and supportive of individuals with autism and other forms of neurodiversity?
I think social media helps so much because we're seeing so many different people's stories. Like, I love seeing on my For You page, other autistic people's stories coming up. I feel like I learned so much from that. And I think we're getting a lot better as a society, but I still think there's so many people out there who are just triggered, you know, if they see something or hear something that like makes them jealous or makes them feel threatened in some way, or if they're coming from a space of scarcity mindset, they just want to attack. And I think everybody, myself included, needs to take a deep breath. And if you feel yourself getting angry or reacting to a person or annoyed with a certain creator, or you want to leave a mean comment, maybe you need to stop and think about, wait, why is this bothering me? You know, there might be a legitimate reason it's bothering you. Some people out there are assholes, but
yeah. How do you deal with online hate? Do you ignore it or?
I tend to try to ignore it. I would like to say I'm completely above it after like 15 years of being in the public eye, but of course I'm not. No. You know, every once in a while I'll see something that hurts my feelings. I just try to sometimes, like, if I get like a crazy comment on YouTube, I'll write like a sassy comeback, but then I'll delete their comment like right after, so then everything disappears. So I feel like I got it off my chest, but like nobody really sees it. But I feel like I'm getting better at it, and I think it's important to realize that the constructive criticism you need to get, I have full faith, will always come back to me. There's always going to be somebody who cares about me or who's in my life or who's working with me who will tell me the constructive criticism I need to hear. I don't need to go seek it out. Like, I make a point of like never looking at Reddit. Like, even if I'm researching something else apart from myself and it leads me to Reddit, I try not to go just because I know the rabbit hole I can go down. So I kind of know my limits. I'll still look at comments on social media and stuff, but they don't tend to be too crazy on my personal pages anymore. And I've evolved over the years too. Like, there's certain things that just don't trigger me anymore. Like when people want to call me a gold digger, I just laugh. Like, that one's just stupid to me. And it's always interesting too, when you look at what triggers you, sometimes you can turn in and take a minute to think about, like, why is that exactly so triggering to me? Like, is that something that's really bothering me? Is that something I need to work on? Because if somebody says something to you that's straight up not true, like if somebody kept leaving comments on your page saying you were a serial killer, you'd just be like, oh my God, this person's fucking wacky, delete. And you'd laugh at it because it's so ridiculous. But if somebody's saying something to me that bothers me a little bit, maybe I need to take some time to think about, like, why is that actually bothering me?
Yeah, and it comes with age, doesn't it? It's mm-hmm. you, as one gets a better understanding of self, like, those comments and triggers are less painful and they kind of penetrate less and they, you know, you can brush them off more easily. But I think it's such a good point to say, it's one does have to kind of check themselves as well and see, like, why that thing is still painful, you know, why does that thing still kind of get at me and make me feel a certain way about myself, even when I know really deep down it couldn't be further from the truth or from mm-hmm. who I am. You know, it's a hard place to navigate, social media.
Yeah, for sure. And I think everybody just needs to remember that it happens to everybody. I used to feel so alone when our show first came out, because back then there wasn't social media, but there would be message boards on the E-Network yes. website, and they were horrendous. And when I first found them, I kept looking and kept reading because I'm like, well, I'm going to find something redeeming eventually, and it's going to make me feel better about myself. But we don't really process information that way as humans. Like, if somebody says something nice to us, it's like, oh, great, cool. But, like, it doesn't penetrate the way a negative comment will. So that's a losing battle. But I learned to, like, not go back to the message boards. But I used to feel so alone. I felt like people were only saying those things about me and my two co-stars. I thought, you know, people just must think we're the worst people in the world because I didn't know what happened to anybody else. And it wasn't till, like, years later I saw, I think it was like Tina Fey or like Reese Witherspoon talking about getting hate online. And I'm like, oh, everybody gets it. Because who would hate on them, you know?
No, exactly.
And it happens to everyone. Like, you don't even have to be famous. Anybody who puts up a TikTok is going to get, like, snarky ass rude comments.
Yeah, I think right now it's like, I see it. It's you can't really do anything right or wrong. I don't know. I don't really know where the line is. It's like there will yeah. always be someone that you're kind of like, going to offend, to be quite mm-hmm. honest. And I don't know how one navigates that. I think it's about, you know, and you said it beautifully, I've read it in many articles you've done, it's really about being authentic, I suppose. Like, maybe that's what it comes down to, is a place of, like, you know, I don't think everyone's going to agree with me, no one's going to mm-hmm. you know, not everyone's going to agree with you either, but it's like, it's about being authentic at the end of the day, you know.
Absolutely. It's really all you can do. And one thing I've learned over the years too is you can think you're explaining something in the most detailed, crystal clear way possible, and there's always going to be people consuming that content who are distracted and not really listening, or kind of listening, or they just see the clickbait headline associated with it and they interpret it the wrong way. Like, one of my favorite stories I've ever heard illustrating this was Elizabeth Gilbert, the woman who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, was telling a story about how she went to a book signing. And if you've ever read that book, she talks about breaking up with her husband before she goes on this trip. And she's very kind about the husband. She's like, I'm not going to talk about what went wrong. There were so many things that were also right. Like, she's very beautiful when she talks about him. But she goes on this book tour and she's signing a book, and somebody comes up to her and she's like, oh my God, I really related to you breaking up with your husband because I had an abusive husband too. And she's like, wait a second, I didn't say that at all. But people, you know, anything you put out there, whether it's a piece of social media content or a piece of art or writing or something, it's a dance between you and who's perceiving it. Like, you can have all kinds of certain intention with one thing, but the person perceiving it is meeting you halfway with all their experiences in life, and they're bouncing that perception off of it. So I mean, I feel pretty understood these days for the most part, but there's still times when like Bridget and I will be talking about something on our podcast and then I'll get a weird comment where somebody's like, you said this, and it's literally like the opposite of what I said. And I'm like, so you just have to keep that in mind that like not everybody's even going to get you.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think, why should they as well? I think that's a bit, you know, it's also that it's a bit like, you know, does everyone have to like me? Not really.
Yeah.
You know? If I wasn't like in the public eye, that wouldn't be even a question, you know? So, and you spoke about, I loved hearing Bridget's name just there. And I know you two work together and it made me so happy to see that you two are still like great friends. And,
oh yeah.
And we spoke at the beginning of the podcast about kind of navigating more difficult relationships and the mansion not always being one that I suppose, that nurtured female relationships, I suppose. And it wasn't something, again, like kind of rewatching the show, it wasn't a great kind of depiction on what we as women can be like to each other. But I know that's not the case. And I think it's so easy and was easy back then for TV to just like make women seem like these like, you know, awful human beings who just hate on each other and are completely competitive. But your relationship with Bridget, it couldn't be further from that. How do you, you know, what do female relationships look like now? And how do you, I suppose, prioritize and nurture the female friendships in your life?
Female friendships have always been super important to me in every phase of my life. And I feel like it's weird. I've seen like both sides of it throughout the years in every area of my life. Like when I lived at the mansion in the early days, like the girlfriends were really pitted against each other. And, you know, there were some really competitive characters there. But also over the years, I made so many friends from the, you know, the playmates who would come in and work and stay at the house and things like that. And Bridget and I are such close friends. So I've really seen both sides where like you can kind of have this like playmate sisterhood, but also we were kind of pitted against each other, you know, amongst the girlfriends anyway. And even like moving off into the spinoff years, I had the same producer who did Girls Next Door do my spinoff and Kendra's spinoff. And I felt like he was trying to pit us against each other to make us more competitive and do what he wanted us to do, which is too bad. But for the most part, I think female friendships are amazing and they've always been a huge priority in my life. I feel like women have a way of listening to other women that just men aren't necessarily that great at all the time. So yeah, I love female friendships.
Oh, I love that. I want to talk a bit more about these kind of like projects that you have coming up, and you're so multifaceted. It was just so, when you said yes, it was so amazing, like kind of like deep diving into everything that you've done since. I think it's so easy. I know we touched on everything at the beginning of your like life, and it's just interesting for us. We have a kind of younger community so that they can get that. But it's so nice to meet someone where they're at as well. Like, what does life look like now? I loved reading about your love of like Disney, which I know has been like an ongoing one, but I love like your YouTube channel and everything that you do with that. And my boyfriend's from Florida, so he took me to like Disney World in Florida. But do you go often to the one in LA?
Yeah, I do. I would say like every other month, maybe a little more around the holidays. Yeah. Like I love taking my kids. My ex-husband loves taking the kids. So they get to go a lot between the two of us. And I have a couple of close friends who are really into Disney. We're members of the club down there. So we'll go and just eat and shop some days, not even go on rides. I just love the atmosphere. In fact, this weekend I'm taking my kids because they just opened a new tower at the Disneyland Hotel. So I want to like try those rooms. And we're just going down there to like have sleepover, do room service, try the new pool because they have this really cool like kids like waiting section and like splash pool. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, it's just nice. It's you know, it's, one can, I suppose, can be grateful for the fact that you were, I suppose, given a platform and you've been able to kind of transcend that platform in your own way and rewrite your story and showcase yourself the way you want to be done. But it was so nice, like, speaking to you now and doing the research and looking at where your life is and just seeing you as, like, we were only given one side of you back then. And it's like, you know, you're so layered, and I love seeing like the kind of more geekier side to you and like all these other interests you have. Obviously you're a mother, but like it's so, I think it's still a thing that happens on TV. It's just like, it's just everything feels quite like kind of, it isn't deep, is it? And I think that's the kind of the shame with reality TV. It's not real, obviously, but so many people think it is. And you know very, you know, only too well how unreal it is, you know? And it's so nice to see you kind of away from that, I suppose, and get a proper glimpse at your character that hasn't been kind of manipulated and molded by men, I suppose. Yeah,
thank you. Yeah, it's crazy going back and watching the episodes, especially in the first season, just how one-dimensional we were and we were made to be. It's nicer in the seasons that follow. We get to show a little bit more completely of ourselves. Yeah, but even after I left, it was like between Hef and the executive producer of the show, they were really trying to paint a certain narrative of like why our relationship ended that wasn't true and try to paint me in a certain way. And it just made me really angry after a while. And I just couldn't take it anymore and just like had to tell the truth.
So what have you got going on now? What are you working on? Where can our listeners find you? Like, tell us everything.
Yeah, I have a podcast called Girls Next Level with Bridget. We talk about the behind the scenes of Girls Next Door and what was really going on. And that drops every Monday, anywhere you can find podcasts. The Playboy Murders is on Investigation Discovery on Monday nights. It also streams on Max and Hulu. And then Lethally Blonde will be coming out in March, also on Investigation Discovery.
Amazing. So tell me a little bit about Lethally Blonde.
Lethally Blonde is very similar to Playboy Murders, but it's not particularly Playboy centric. It's very intriguing true crime cases that involve people with really interesting lifestyles. A lot of them are in the sex work industry or along the fringes of it. The premiere episode, I believe, involves an OnlyFans model, and they're really interesting cases. So I'm super excited to share those with everybody.
Oh, thank you so much, Holly, for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
We may have stopped talking, but that doesn't mean you have to. Talk to us on our Instagram at Girls Talk, or send us your poetry, essays, stories, artwork, or anything else you want to share at girlstalk.com. This week's podcast was produced by Girls Talk and Wicked Child Studio. Original music composed by Mikey Long. Mad, mad, mad love to Joe Malone London for their generous support of the podcast. And as always, we are always here and we're always listening. I'm Adjoa Boa, and this was the Girls Talk podcast.